Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to a podcast from the BBC World Service. This is Hard Talk with me, Stephen Sacker. Thanks for downloading this edition of the programme. I do hope you enjoy it.
Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. My guest today recently swapped military uniform for the ermine robes of the British House of Lords. But though now retired, David Richards, Lord Richards, remains a soldier to his fingertips. His last post was Chief of the UK Defence Staff, in which he offered his military advice direct to Prime Minister David Cameron. His tenure in the job encompassed the Western military campaign against Colonel Gaddafi in Libya and the vexed question of whether to launch strikes against President Bashar al-Assad's forces in Syria. In the event, the latter intervention was never made. But just a year later, a US-led coalition is bombing Syria in an operation aimed not at Assad's forces, but at the movement that calls itself Islamic State. British warplanes are also involved, though their missions are restricted to IS targets in Iraq. So what exactly is going on here? Is this the beginning of another long Western military involvement in the Middle East? And what kind of strategic vision do Messrs. Obama, Cameron and the rest have? Well, David Richards has long experience of leading difficult military missions from Afghanistan to Sierra Leone to Iraq. What does he make of this latest Western effort to project military power in the Middle East? Lord Richards, welcome to Hard Talk. Till just over a year ago, you were Britain's military chief. I just wonder whether you can now acknowledge that you didn't see this Islamic State threat coming.
No, I'm not going to acknowledge that. Back in 2012, as was my job, we gave the British government, and I think it went to the American government as well, a plan to deal with Assad. But one reason we were keen on it was that it would nip the already then growing problem of extremist Muslims in the bud. So I'm not saying I and my staff officers who helped me with this have all knowledge on these things, but it was clear even then this was going to be a problem.
Right. So you are suggesting then that the politicians didn't listen to your advice?
I, as many military men do, it's my job, came up with lots of contingency plans. Most of them, by definition, are not listened to by our politicians. And it was a very, very big ask. I mean, it was a purist plan. I think it was one certainly worth them examining. But it was more than the market would bear, was the response. And I sense that was always likely to be the case.
This, I take it, is the plan. And of course, you've written a book, a memoir, which goes into this in some detail. A plan which would have, rather than put Western boots on the ground in Syria, would have trained a massive force of Syrians, loosely we could say the moderate Syrian fighting elements, to become an effective force to take on Assad, and you believed, beat him. The politicians rejected that idea.
I'm not certain it ever really got to serious consideration, because you go back to late 2011, 2012, it looked like Assad was sort of, you know, on his beam ends in nautical speech and didn't really need the scale of effort that I was suggesting was required. There were other techniques they were trying. My worry was that they weren't going to be sufficient, and I'm an old-fashioned soldier, I'm the first to admit that, that if you're going to go into a war, my belief is you better do it properly or probably better not do it at all.
Well, that's a very important statement, and I want to tease it out as we talk about what is happening today in Syria and Iraq. But I couldn't help noticing in the sort of foreword to this book, a friend of yours, I take it, a man of some distinction in reporting the military here in Britain, Max Hastings, he describes how you, in his words, annoyed your political masters by rejecting their schoolboyish ideas, by insisting that British military interventions shouldn't be driven by soundbites. Now, is that a fair reflection of how you have felt during the course of your career as a senior officer about the nature of politicians' relationship to the military?
No, I mean, those are very much Max's words.
You put them at the foreword of your book, so you presumably feel that there's some merit to them.
I actually asked Max to write a foreword, and he very kindly agreed to do it. I had no editorial control over it. And when I read it, I thought, oh dear, this isn't going to be very helpful. But if that's what Max's view is, and those that he talks to, which are, you know, many people who are close to government, then fair enough. I actually didn't find them like that. I believe that we had lots of very involved and difficult discussions in the National Security Council.
But I suppose what I'm getting at is this idea that politicians, in your experience, have been driven by short-termism and by a sort of soundbite need. And I just wonder, when we now switch to talk about what is happening on the ground in Syria and Iraq today, and the fact that there is a coalition of sorts making a military intervention against Islamic State, whether you feel it is an intervention which again is being driven more by short-term need than real long-term strategic overview.
I do think that there's a risk in this very media-conscious world in which particularly social media drives a lot of government, as well as elections and all the usual things, that there is a risk that the short-term trumps the long-term and the strategic.
Let's be blunt. Is that happening with the way Obama and Cameron and others are handling their intervention policy today?
I don't think it's yet fair to say that, but there is a risk of it, certainly. But both the Prime Minister and President Obama talk about a generational struggle, so they're saying all the right things. My worry, and it's no more than that at the moment, is that the scale of the challenge which they rightly want to confront is not yet met by the scale of the response. And that's the point of your question.
Of course it is. And you rightly point out the language coming from Washington and London. It's existential. It's about taking on a network of death. It's about degrading and then eliminating what is seen as a threat, not just to the region, but to the entire world. And yet, what we have is a military intervention which right now has so many caveats around it that it could have been launched by a bunch of lawyers.
Well, I won't necessarily agree with the bunch of lawyers thing, but I essentially agree with your point that if we're going to achieve the policy goals that they have now set themselves and us, then there's going to have to be much more effort put into it.
Boots on the ground is, of course, the cliche. But in the end, as we see the fight, particularly in Syria right now, where the Americans, but not the British, because of one of those caveats, the British won't bomb in Syria, but the Americans will. But what we see is the bombing isn't working. And that right now, particularly in northern Syria, in the Kurdish areas close to the Turkish border, Islamic State is still on the offensive. It's taking serious amounts of territory. Does that mean that the only reasonable strategic response is for the West to put boots on the ground?
Well, I look at what our policy goals are, and I don't necessarily agree or disagree with them. As a soldier doing his analysis, as one does, my deduction is that there is going to be an increasingly strong case for Western involvement on the ground. But that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, right up in the front line. It means logistic support, command and control, which is key, which is very difficult to achieve effective command and control, particularly over such a disparate group that we're now talking about. So I do think this is coming our way. I do think the Prime Minister...
How long before that reality is going to hit the politicians?
I don't know. You're better than me at this, probably, Stephen, but I think it's not far off.
I know that I am not better than you at this, because you're speaking from decades of military experience. It is actually very important to tease this out with you, because, you know, if we are talking about whether there's any strategic coherence to what is happening in Iraq and Syria today, we need to believe that our politicians have thought this through.
Well, I do think they're thinking it through very carefully. Everything I'm hearing from the other side of the Atlantic is good. I totally trust General Marty Dempsey, and my successor here, General Nick Horton, will be giving the same advice as we're now discussing here on the TV.
But with respect, what you are saying is that both Obama and Cameron were wrong to be entirely explicit when they said there will not be troops on the ground.
I wouldn't have said it. And, of course, there are variations on a theme. No boots on the ground in most people's minds means up in the front line, sort of bayonets fixed, charging, that sort of thing. There are variations on that theme that means you can have much of the same effect. I don't know which version the Prime Minister, for example, was talking about, but I do know we've already got some troops in Iraq, and I suspect also in other countries surrounding Syria, that are giving the sort of advice I'm advocating.
Is there a sense of paralysis because of politicians' knowledge of the public disillusion with what happened in Iraq post-2003?
I think there is, and they're inevitably playing to that. My sort of rather trite response is don't let clumsily executed campaigns ruin the lessons of a long history. And that long history suggests that only when you close with and engage on the ground efficiently and quickly and en masse with your opponent are you actually going to win.
What they say, of course, and I'm thinking now of the leaderships in Washington and London, is that we can be quite explicit about not putting our boots on the ground because we are confident we can work with regional and local fighting forces who will do the job for us. Now, when you look at the quality and the state of the Iraqi army, of the so-called moderate Free Syrian Army forces in Syria, do you give that one iota of credence?
You can do it, but it's going to take a long time, and the question is how much time have we got? Because during that period, which I think would take 9 to 12 months minimum, your enemy, the ISIS, are also going to be doing things. And whether air power alone in that period can downgrade them and write them down and worry them to stop them achieving their own goals, let alone outside Syria and Iraq, but perhaps in our own backyards, I think that is the issue that we now need to grapple with.
Where does morality come into this? For example, right now in Iraq, frankly, the most useful fighting forces who appear ready to counter, if they can, the Islamic State threat are Shia militia forces, loosely allied to the Baghdad government, but as we see from recent events in some Sunni towns, prepared to undertake the most brutal, abusive military operations to achieve their sectarian ends. Do you believe that the so-called coalition should hold its nose and work with those people?
I think we've got to be very careful. I'm not judging them, because amongst them I'm sure there's some very brave soldiers who believe in their cause. But the fact is that they're going into Sunni territory, and we have to take the Sunni tribes and leadership with us, which is why there is a good case, by the way, for taking our time on this to make sure we get those building blocks right. I'd be very cautious about backing anybody regardless. The issue of President Assad in Syria is probably a little bit different, and we need to think that through as well. But I'd be cautious of going into Sunni tribal areas with those militias, given the temperature between them at the moment.
Yeah, let's talk about a different aspect of this idea that the region will do the heavy lifting in sorting out its own problems. The region, of course, includes Saudi Arabia. It includes Qatar. Now, they are nominally part of the military coalition bombing Iraq and Syria right now. But you have sat, I'm sure, in dozens of top-level intelligence and military briefings with your colleagues from these countries. Why did you never call them out on their consistent tolerance of support from their countries to these jihadi extremists?
Well, it's a very good question, and the practicality of it as a general is a slight cop-out here, that the politicians provide the environment in which people like me work. We had to get on and work with them almost regardless. But I would like to point out...
And did you say to your political masters, you know what, there is an unreality here. You're telling me to work with these people, and some of these people are the very problem that we are facing.
None of the people that we actually worked with, i.e. the Qatari and Saudi generals, I'm convinced were doing the sort of thing you're suggesting. I don't know the degree to which they were doing this as a state-run business, as opposed to very wealthy individuals who were misguidedly supporting the people that today are ISIS. Whether those states are now suppressing the individual's ability to do that, I'm not certain, but I suspect, and what I hear, they most certainly are. I think these states have sort of rather naively, if I may, thought that this wouldn't come back to bite us. That is undoubtedly no longer the case, and I'm confident that they are getting a grip of the problem.
I just wonder if you are, you know, obviously no longer in uniform and prepared to be frank with me, whether you are now prepared to acknowledge that when it comes to understanding what is really happening on the ground in Syria, in Iraq, frankly, many places in the Middle East, we are operating pretty blind. We don't really understand.
I agree with you. Funnily enough, in military doctrine schools, at the staff colleges and so on, the first requirement before you get involved in any operation is to understand. It's actually called the understand function in a rather unglamorous way. We don't understand enough, which is why there is a good case for taking our time here to make sure we understand sufficient.
But you've just said we don't have time.
No, I've said this is a question that the politicians now need to answer. Have they got time in which to do the sort of thing I was proposing? If they haven't got time, and there's a debate to be had, a very serious one, obviously, then the only solution to doing it in an efficient way is for us to get more heavily involved on the ground.
You see, very specifically, and this is obviously very pressing in the wake of the most recent horrific pictures of the killing of Alan Henning, there are captives on the ground, and we know they're somewhere around Raqqa, the headquarters of Islamic State in Syria, but we obviously have no idea where. There are many people in the West saying to the government in the UK and in America, send special forces in, do something now. But if we are so blind on the ground in the region, that can't happen, can it?
No, I think you've got to be very careful about suggesting special forces are that special. They're still human with fragility, and they, on the whole, are very cautious at the point of actually executing an operation, quite rightly. Unless they know there's a good chance of them pulling it off and them getting back, they rightly will advise against it. So I'm afraid that is not going to be a panacea in the way some people are suggesting, which, of course, is why they haven't been used hitherto.
Do you believe that there are people in the security establishments in the UK and the US who are at least close to knowing where these people are?
I would like to think so. The problem then, in terms of executing some sort of operation, is can you actually get at them safely? And, of course, because we've trailed it as an option, the chances are it'll be being made very much more difficult than it might well have been.
I wonder, if I may, have you talk a little bit about morality. You've had a very long military career, and in the course of that military career, you have engaged in pretty clear out-and-out humanitarian interventions. For example, you led the mission in Sierra Leone in the early years of the Blair government, which was putting British lives on the line for an interest which was much more humanitarian than national security. And yet now, the mood in the nation, and maybe in the military too, appears to be to retract, go back, retreat from the notion of responsibility to protect, humanitarian interventions. Do you still believe in humanitarian interventions?
I do, actually. I like to count myself as a sort of moral guy. But like the one in Sierra Leone, and I hope I bring this out in my book, that when you do it properly, on a scale that will guarantee you success, or with techniques that will guarantee you success. The worst of all worlds is to do it half-heartedly. And because we have not, for example, had the troop numbers in Afghanistan that we needed until 2010, when things actually improved measurably, actually, and the same similarly in Iraq, we've got this whole thing, it's got a bad reputation. But if another Rwanda came along...
It's got a bad reputation because these things are always so complicated that morality in the end seems to get chucked out of the window. For example, in Syria today, if Western leaders are honest, I think, they would say, and I've heard this from US officials in private, that the idea of Assad being toppled would be their worst nightmare. And yet Assad remains the man accused by the United Nations of the most egregious war crimes and human rights abuses, who is believed to have used chemical weapons against his own people, whom we know uses barrel bombs against civilians in Aleppo and elsewhere. And yet right now we are attacking Assad's enemies and tacitly saying we can't afford for him to go. Where's the morality in that?
Back in 2012, before ISIS had risen to what it is today, I think there was a very strong, compelling moral case for dealing with Assad efficiently and quickly. And the sort of scheme that we talked about earlier might well have achieved that. Today, as a result of us not doing it properly, we kept the opposition alive, if you like, through humanitarian aid, but no lethal aid, as I think it was the term. We did enough to let the war go on, but not enough to actually resolve it. And I wonder if that is a less moral solution, given the awful things that have happened over the last 2 or 3 years, than would have been actually dealing with it aggressively and quickly at the time. And those sort of questions, to me, come back to the point, if you are going to do it, then you must do it quickly and efficiently and have a political framework always within which that military operation is nested.
You've made that point several times, and it actually raises in my mind an interesting question about whether the West is led by people in this modern era who are prepared to make those strong, decisive, full-on rather than half-hearted national security decisions.
Well, I do think it's going back to your excellent point about the media and short-termism.
Oh, come on, you can't blame this on the media.
not exclusive, but fundamentally,
maybe you can blame it on a fundamental failure of will in the West, and you see it, for example, in the failure to meet basic funding commitments within NATO, which has driven the Americans crazy for years. You see it perhaps in the way Putin looks at what he sees as weakness in the West and decides he can invade Crimea and parts of Ukraine and not really worry too much about the consequences.
I think there's a lot in what you say, but the media...
And did you feel this when you were still in uniform dealing with the politicians in Westminster?
Yes, I mean, what one... You've got to, as I've, again, I've tried to bring out a bit in my book, that what might have happened, it could have been far worse. You fight a good battle, you mitigate the worst excesses, and you walk away bruised, but it'll do. I mean, in the case of Britain's and other countries' funding of its NATO commitment, I think it's absolutely vital now. And this is going to be the acid test for this government and whoever is next in power. When they talk about doing the right thing, regardless of consequence, etc., etc., if politicians say that and come next year cut defence further, then I'm afraid it will all have been for nothing. So I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt, if you like, to next year, and at that point there will be an acid
test. Well, with respect, you know already, do you not, that they are not going to keep the promises that they've made. For example, RUSI, a very respected think tank looking at the military, has said that the UK share of spend on the military, a share of GDP, is going to go down to 1.8%. Now, it's supposed to be, according to NATO's lights, 2%, but it's going to fall below that. Cameron's now announced new fiscal plans, including tax cuts and new public spending squeezes. The military is going to be squeezed tighter than ever.
First of all, decisions have yet to be finally made. I know David Cameron well enough to know that personally he would like to keep it at or above 2%. I'm not certain that that is his coalition colleagues' view. In fact, I know it isn't, which is fair enough. This is what politics are all about.
Well, military colleagues of yours, perhaps less tactful than you, have said we are going to be a hollowed-out military.
Well, that is the risk. If come next year, when the decisions are made, we do not, and this is with the economy growing, I would have thought it's doable, if we do not match the 2% spending target, which we, ironically, have spent, and the Prime Minister majored on this, spent a lot of time advocating for countries to do at the Welsh summit recently.
You seem to be saying to me, and this is a theme that's run through the course of this interview, that the politicians are not being straight on this, and that your message on financing the military is, if they don't keep the promises they've made before, they will be making a mockery of everything they're saying about the determination to take on Islamic State.
I think that would be true. So they've got until next year, in my view, to make sure that their promises are met. Otherwise, how can you say that we're going to do everything that we need to do to solve this insidious problem and then cut our ability to do it? It doesn't stack up. So I'm confident that the Prime Minister, who is loyal on this to us and to his words, would like to do it. The problem isn't going to be key people in and around the current government. It's going to be whether he can carry the politicians en masse with him. And I think that's a big problem, as we've seen recently.
We have to end there. Lord Richards, thanks for being on Hard Talk.
Thank you very much.
That was an edition of Hard Talk presented by me, Stephen Sacker. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hi. I'm Katia Adler from the Global Story podcast, and we're looking at this summer's Paris Olympics and Paralympics. Hosting the Games puts a lot of pressure on a city. This means hosting isn't quite as appealing as it once used to be. The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your BBC podcasts.